Thanks, Caroline. I have to say, I feel like everything I was planning to say in a way has already been said, so maybe I'll talk a little bit more from the perspective of someone who's newer to the field of health and all policies, at least in an explicit sense, and we'll just briefly talk about my two personal experiences working in this field. So the first part of my talk, or the majority of it, I think, will be just reflections on what I think compels non-health sector policymakers to prioritize health. And I'll talk a little bit about the example of our work in Baltimore City, and then again talk about, particularly from the standpoint of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, engaging in the National Prevention Strategy process, and then some takeaways from those two experiences that I think will resonate a lot with the takeaways you've already heard. So I don't have any conflicts of interest, and I just put this in to say that I'm not representing official positions either of Baltimore City government or of the federal government in my remarks today. So I just love this quote, and I thought it was a nice way to start because for me it really just makes the connection between health and all policies and what I learned about in grad school and saw like Aaron in clinic, which is the importance of the social environment and social determinants on the health, in my case, of children in our country. And I also like this quote because it brings in this tension between individual responsibility and sort of social responsibility or systematic change. So health is greatly influenced by lifestyles and environments. These are not only individual choices, but they often have strong social, cultural, economical, and environmental determinants, and comes from the director of the National Public Health Institute in Finland, I think during the time when Finland was heading the EU government and working extensively on health and all policies in Europe. So with respect to the health impact assessment we did in Baltimore, I mean, the timing for me was really fortuitous in the sense that we finished this health impact assessment report right before I started a year away from Hopkins working at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And actually, the process of doing this really helped me to understand what I would want out of an experience working at the federal level, and really that part of that for me would be understanding in more depth the priorities of a non-health agency. And so I was really excited to have the opportunity to work at a non-health agency, and I think working on zoning, which got a crash course in what zoning is as a policy tool, probably made me a little more attractive to a housing and planning agency in particular to think about taking a risk on someone who's who's not sort of a policy expert in that area. And so our general objectives were to use expert opinion and literature review, as well as some quantitative assessments, to inform stakeholders and decision makers about the first version of a draft new code for Baltimore City with respect to promoting healthy communities and decreasing disparities. And we had funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and we're particularly interested in childhood obesity as part of that. And then to provide recommendations to increase the health promoting potential of the new code and mitigate the potential for unanticipated negative health consequences. I don't know that it's entirely unique, but we felt to some extent that the way we decided to focus our health impact assessment was a little bit different than some we had been seen done in the past with respect to urban planning projects, in that we were particularly interested in the built environment's impact on the social environment through crime. And I think part of that related to the fact that we tried to narrow our focus based on five leading causes of death in Baltimore City and areas where there were significant excess morbidity and mortality in Baltimore compared to the state as a whole. And I think through our stakeholder interviews and interviews with decision makers, the issue of crime in Baltimore was a pretty salient one that people didn't necessarily at first see as a health issue, but were able to make that connection relatively readily. So this busy slide I just included to show that when we were doing our analysis of the zoning code, it was, you know, it's difficult to do a side-by-side comparison of these long contingent documents. We were really fortunate to have an amazing self-taught zoning expert, a graduate student who read the two codes in comparison in great detail. And in combination with the findings from our lit review, I think we zeroed in on the issue of alcohol outlet distribution, and in the abstract, tried to identify, without the maps having actually been done on the code yet, what the potential would be for changes to the distribution of alcohol outlets in the city based on some of the things that we thought, you know, had a lot of positive benefits, like creating transit-oriented development overlay zones and trying to focus on mixed-use development. But, you know, included in that were allowances for different types of alcohol outlets that could potentially also be problematic for crime rates in their vicinity. And then with particular attention towards equity, we were looking at the differential, potential differential effects for low-income versus high poverty neighborhoods versus low poverty neighborhoods. So I think we saw that there was the potential for changes in the distribution or concentration of alcohol outlets in both low and high poverty neighborhoods, but that the problem of crime at baseline was potentially much more of an issue for high poverty neighborhoods. So that led to a variety of recommendations, and I think, like Aaron mentioned before, we found ourselves in the situation where, in large part, we were congratulating the planning department for some of the decisions they had made to include a lot of attention to pedestrian-oriented design, to mixed-use development, to sort of curbing expansion of kind of auto-friendly parking lots and things like that in the downtown area. And that did a lot, I think, to foster an improved relationship over time with the planners, who at first, I think, were a little bit concerned that we were going to, you know, be a dissenting voice against what was a monumental effort 40 years since the last zoning code had been written for the city. And by the end of the process, when they were introducing the first draft of the new code, health was actually sort of a salient topic they would mention as a positive about what was coming out of the process. I think that allowed us to have sort of a few areas where we provided some recommendations that were probably, you know, not probably, definitely controversial in some regard, but gave us credibility because we weren't only saying what was not quite right, we were actually, you know, congratulating them at the same time. And it led to, part of that led to two recommendations around alcohol outlet concentration, which I'm focusing on here because I think that's the piece that continues to be important. So one was preventing concentration of off-premise alcohol sales outlets in districts where currently allowed with emphasis on new transit-oriented development or industrial mixed-use zones. And the second was to employ comprehensive planning strategies to address problematic existing outlets via some deemed approved process or review process. So, you know, I think we were also fortunate because, not being alcohol and public health experts, we drew on the evidence that had been built, a lot of it by colleagues at Johns Hopkins, but made it salient to a policymaking process that allowed for leveraging interest and commitment from non-health agencies, in addition to having a new health commissioner in Baltimore City who also saw this as an important part of her agenda in creating health-promoting neighborhoods, and actually included a goal of reducing alcohol outlet density in the city as part of her Healthy Baltimore 2015 strategic planning report. So to that end, I think during the course of the past year, there's still been a lot of ongoing discussions of the code. They now have released the second draft for public comment, and behind the scenes, there's alliance between multiple executive branch agencies at the city level who are thinking about ways to work together to make the case, probably using different strategies than the initial strategy we had proposed. But I think it speaks to how, you know, health leadership has to really identify or endorse already identified mechanisms through a non-health policy as relevant and salient to their goals of improving health. So it's kind of what Elizabeth talked about you leveraging that that awareness or understanding of a non-health policy and how it can impact, and then getting behind it and supporting it with health as the lens. So now moving to the National Prevention Strategy effort, and I'll skip sort of a broad introduction because you've heard a bit about the context for this. But again, I think it is one of those moments in time, windows of opportunity, and a powerful time for expanding the conversation about health in all policies. And I think part of that comes from the fact that, you know, there's an explicit attention to these issues at the highest levels of the federal government. And the Affordable Care Act just, you know, was a monumental achievement in many ways, and not just an achievement for health insurance reform and health care reform, but also for changing the way we think about prevention and wellness. I also think, and I don't know that this was, you know, I not being there from the sort of beginning conception of this, but I think there are some other windows that the Obama administration has created that weren't necessarily envisioned as windows of opportunity for health in all policies, but have created an environment to promote a more holistic approach to the way that the federal government approaches complex problems in local communities that are multifactorial. And one of those is a focus on interagency collaboration. So whether it's, you know, reviving the Environmental Justice Executive Order and establishing again a working interagency work group on environmental justice issues, whether it's the National Prevention Strategy that's, you know, founded on interagency collaboration, whether it's the Neighborhood Revitalization Initiative, or the Sustainable Communities Partnership. There's an emphasis that most of the complex problems that localities are facing can't be rectified or solved by one, you know, part of this kind of siloed government, that on the ground, you know, people don't distinguish, you know, whether the funds from the planning department built their sidewalk, or, you know, a CDC program or a HUD program was responsible for lead abatement in their housing unit. And then I think that also an explicit emphasis on place-based policy, which has come out of the Office of Management and Budget, where they identify things like economic growth, sustainability, and neighborhood revitalization, but also made the distinction between addressing the needs of populations that are sort of identified by demographic characteristics versus investing in geographic areas and trying to produce concentrated investment to overcome concentrated disadvantage. Again, resonates with this sort of social determinants lens. And while not explicitly about health in all policies, I do think the comparative effectiveness emphasis is another emphasis at the sort of budgetary or highest levels of the federal government around the need for evidence or desire to approach policies that are going to produce the greatest results with the least cost, given the constraints we're living under economically. So a little bit about my experience at HUD. So first of all, the mission of HUD is to create strong, sustainable, inclusive communities and quality, affordable homes for all. And this was the sort of the revised mission with this administration, and also delineated in the strategic plan were two areas where I think one was more of an explicit focus on health, and the second was a focus on health that I think was partially in existence when I got there, but we've tried to kind of increase the connections or the awareness of the connections. So goal 3 of their strategic plan was to utilize housing as a platform to improve quality of life, with particular emphasis on the connections between housing and educational attainment, health, economic security, housing stability, and public safety, and to use HUD assistance to improve the health of HUD residents. And then goal 4 was really within the lens of sustainability. But I think, as you heard from Linda, there is this nexus between sustainability and health, which resonates with a lot of the advocacy community and planning and public health community. And it's to build inclusive and sustainable communities free from discrimination. So again, the explicit emphasis on reducing racially concentrated areas of poverty, of addressing concentrated disadvantage. When you look at HUD programs sort of historically, and this relates, I think, to what we heard from Elizabeth about, you know, how sometimes the health-relevant agencies will get pulled into these health and all policies projects, and when I got there, I think the explicit emphasis on health, or the readily identified by people who are housing policy experts, was in the Office of Healthy Homes and Lead Hazard Control, and then around homelessness programs and other housing programs for special populations like people with HIV/AIDS, disabled and elderly populations, and on connecting people to health services. Less of a clear, although I think there were grains of it already there, was around things like affordable housing, community and economic development, neighborhood revitalization and neighborhood stabilization programs, and this broader set of issues around sustainability. So in our, we were really thoughtful as we were contributing to the National Prevention Strategy process to really try and identify core functions of HUD as the focus for our input to the strategy. And I think that that helped it to resonate within the HUD community, and I think, you know, at least in the short term will increase the potential for this to actually, for there to be achievable benchmarks that can be measured through HUD's progress on its own, meeting its own priorities. And these are, we mostly contributed to the Healthy and Safe Community Environments chapter. I think it was a really strategic move on the part of our designee and the secretary to identify that we're not going to dilute the focus too much and really try to align our inputs with the core mission of HUD as a department and step outside the sort of health-relevant box. So the focus on promoting affordable, accessible, safe, and healthy housing resonates with the commitment, strong commitment that HUD has to housing as many people as possible, given that housing assistance is not an entitlement and the need far exceeds the supply. Integrating health criteria into decision-making across multiple sectors, I think there's evidence of that in the way that the Sustainable Communities Grants have been structured. And other efforts ongoing at HUD and in other collaborations like the Sustainable Communities Partnership and Neighborhood Revitalization, and then cross-sector collaboration and community planning and design. So for me, I think just to reiterate again this idea that the top priority, that health isn't always a top priority, but it can sometimes rally additional supporters. The local example in Baltimore of how it became something that the planners felt would increase support for the zoning recode versus serve as an impediment. We've heard similar stories from local sustainable communities grantees who found aligning their work around sustainable planning with the Let's Move campaign and efforts to reduce childhood obesity or other things increases support for something that might otherwise be conceived as sort of social engineering. And then that the need for crossover expertise is really on the health side. That we need to understand our these other constituents better. And Aaron alluded to this a couple times. I think this is a really important area for future research. This whole idea of costs and savings and confronting the fact that at some point there's a limited supply of economic supply and we have to identify the most effective way to improve the health of the largest population, you know, of people. And then the data issues. So anyone who last night heard the discussion about the Moving to Opportunity study, it's a perfect example where the Housers weren't thinking about health when they did this grand social experiment, randomized trial of moving people to low-poverty neighborhoods, only looking at economic effects, and subsequently have realized that health was sort of left out in their early analyses. And so I think that's one of those times where understanding the policy experiments going on and getting in early can be helpful to the conversation. Thanks.